Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks. Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I just want to let you know that I am launching a brand new show this Sunday on April 14th. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. If Sleepy has been a cozy way to end your day, well, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. New episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can just relax and zone out to a good book. Our first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think The Enchanted April is very clearly a perfect story for this season. Well, you can listen to it this Sunday. You can find The Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. The trailer is already up for you right now to hear, and I'll be launching three whole episodes this Sunday for you to binge. The show has been a long time coming, and I'm really excited to bring you more stories, so go subscribe and stay tuned for The Daily Book Club. Thanks. Hey, my name's Otis Gray, and you're listening to Sleepy. A podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep. And this is a midweek bedtime story for you. I hope you've really been liking these midweek stories. I've been really loving, being able to do that for you in the middle of the week. It also gets me reading short stories more rather than just the beginning of all these wonderful books. So, I hope you've been liking them. If you do, please let me know in a response on Spotify or review an Apple Podcasts, or go find us on Instagram at sleepy_podcast. So every Sunday we'll be doing our longer episodes, where we do full stories, and that is when I get to thank all of our brand new patrons on patreon.com, which is a website where you can go and listen to an ad-free version of the show. If that's something that you're interested in, you can go and support with $2 and get a totally ad-free version of Sleepy at patreon.com/sleepyradio. And people who help out with this show, the music that you're hearing is by my good friend James Lepkowski, and the cover art for Sleepy is by Gracie Kanan. Tonight, I am going to be bringing you the first part of a longer short story by the one and only Jack London. Now, I'm sure you have heard of Jack London, most famous for, probably White Fang. He was an incredibly prolific author and his stories are extremely visceral and intense, which is kind of why I haven't read them on this show before. That said, you know, the machismo aside, his writing truly is beautiful, at least to me. It's really lovely to read out loud. And he has this series of short stories called To Build a Fire and other short stories. And he has a bunch of short stories from the Klondike, which he loved to write about. And tonight I'm going to be reading one of his stories, which is called Love of Life. It really is a beautifully told story. It's very Jack London, but I figured I would give you a little variety in case you like Jack London and you've been waiting to hear from him. So tonight, I'm going to be reading part one of the short story, Love of Life, by Jack London. And next week on Wednesday, you'll get to hear part two. And now is the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. Love of Life. This out of all will remain. They have lived and have tossed. So much of the game will be gain, though the gold of the dice has been lost. They limped painfully down the bank, and once the foremost of the two men staggered among the rough-strewn rocks. They were tired and weak, and their faces had the drawn expression of patience which comes from hardship long endured. They were heavily burdened with blanket packs, which were strapped to their shoulders. Head straps, passing across the forehead, helped support these packs. Each man carried a rifle. They walked in a stooped posture, the shoulders well forward, the head still farther forward, the eyes bent upon the ground. I wish we had just two of them cartridges that's laying in the cache of Arn, said the second man. His voice was utterly and drearily expressionless. He spoke without enthusiasm, and the first man, limping into the milky stream that foamed over the rocks, vouchsafed no reply. The other man followed at his heels. They did not remove their footgear, though the water was icy cold. So cold that their ankles ached and their feet went numb. In places the water dashed against their knees, and both men staggered for footing. The man who followed slipped on a smooth boulder, nearly fell, but recovered himself with a violent effort, at the same time uttering a sharp exclamation of pain. He seemed faint and dizzy, and put out his free hand while he reeled, as though seeking support against the air. When he had steadied himself, he stepped forward, but reeled again, then nearly fell. Then he stood still and looked at the other man, who had never turned his head. The man stood still for fully a minute, as though debating with himself. Then he called out, "I say, Bill, I've sprained my ankle." Bill staggered on through the milky water. He did not look around. The man watched him go, and though his face was expressionless as ever, his eyes were like the eyes of a wounded deer. The other man limped up the farther bank and continued straight on without looking back. The man in the stream watched him. His eyes trembled a little, so that the rough thatch of brown hair which covered them was visibly agitated. His tongue even strayed out to moisten them. "Bill," he cried out. It was the pleading cry of a strong man in distress, but Bill's head did not turn. The man watched him go, limping grotesquely and lurching forward with stammering gait, up the slow slope toward the soft skyline of the low-lying hill. He watched him go till he passed over the crest and disappeared. Then he turned his gaze and slowly took in the circle of the world that remained to him now that Bill was gone. Near the horizon, the sun was smoldering dimly, almost obscured by formless mists and vapors, which gave an impression of mass and density without outline or tangibility. The man pulled out his watch, the while resting his weight on one leg. It was 4 o'clock, and as the season was near the last of July or first of August, he did not know the precise date within a week or two. He knew that the sun roughly marked the northwest. He looked to the south and knew that somewhere beyond those bleak hills lay the Great Bear Lake. Also, he knew that in the direction of the Arctic Circle cut its forbidding way across the Canadian Barrens. The stream in which he stood as a feeder to the Coppermine River, which in turn flowed north and emptied into Coronation Gulf and the Arctic Ocean. He had never been there, but he had seen it once on a Hudson Bay Company chart. Again, his gaze completed the circle of the world about him. It was not a heartening spectacle. Everywhere was soft skyline. The hills were all low-lying. There were no trees, no shrubs, no grasses, naught but a tremendous and terrible desolation that sent fear swiftly dawning into his eyes. "Bill," he whispered, once and twice. "Bill." He cowered in the midst of the milky water, as though the vastness were pressing in upon him with overwhelming force, brutally crushing him with its complacent awfulness. He began to shake as with an ague, till the gun fell from his hand with a splash. This served to rouse him. He fought with his fear and pulled himself together, groping in the water and recovering the weapon. He hitched his pack farther over on his left shoulder, so as to take a portion of its weight from off the injured ankle. Then he proceeded, slowly and carefully, wincing with pain, to the bank. He did not stop. With a desperation that was madness, unmindful of the pain, he hurried up the slope to the crest of the hill, over which his comrade had disappeared. More grotesque and comical by far than that limping, jerking comrade. But at the crest he saw a shallow valley, empty of life. He fought with his fear again, overcame it, hitched the pack still farther on over his left shoulder, and lurched on down the slope. The bottom of the valley was soggy with water, which the thick moss held, sponge-like, close to the surface. This water squirted out from under his feet at every step, and each time he lifted a foot, the action culminated in a sucking sound at the wet moss reluctantly releasing its grip. He picked his way from muskeg to muskeg, and followed the other man's footsteps along and across the rocky ledges, which thrust like islets through the sea of moss. Though alone, he was not lost. Farther on, he knew he would come to where dead spruce and fir, very small and weazened, bordered the shore of a little lake, the Titchin Nitchley, in the tongue of the country, the land of the little sticks. And into that lake flowed a small stream, the water of which was not milky. There was rush grass in that stream. This he remembered well. But no timber, and he would follow it till its first trickle ceased at a divide. He would cross this divide to the first trickle of another stream, following to the west, which he would follow until it emptied into the River Dease. And here he would find a cache under an upturned canoe and piled over with many rocks. And in this cache would be ammunition for his empty gun, fish hooks and lines, a small net, all the utilities for the killing and snaring of food. Also, he would find flour, not much, a piece of bacon and some beans. Bill would be waiting for him there, and they would paddle away south down the Dease to the Great Bear Lake. And south across the lake they would go, ever south, till they gained the Mackenzie. And south, still south they would go, while the winter raced vainly after them, and the ice formed in the eddies, and the days grew chill and crisp, south to some warm Hudson Bay Company post, where timber grew tall and generous, and there was grub without end. These were the thoughts of the man as he strove onward. But hard as he strove with his body, he strove equally hard with his mind, trying to think that Bill had not deserted him, that Bill would surely wait for him at the cache. He was compelled to think this thought, or else there would not be any use to strive, and he would have lain down and died. And as the dim ball of the sun sank slowly into the northwest, it covered every inch, and many times of his and Bill's flight south before the downcoming winter. And he conned the grub of the cache and the grub of the Hudson Bay Company post over and over again. He had not eaten for 2 days. For a far longer time, he had not had all he wanted to eat. Often he stooped and picked pale muskeg berries, put them into his mouth and chewed them and swallowed them. A muskeg berry is a bit of seed enclosed in a bit of water. In the mouth, the water melts away and the seed chews sharp and bitter. The man knew there was no nourishment in the berries, but he chewed them patiently with a hope greater than knowledge and defying experience. At 9 o'clock, he stubbed his toe on a rocky ledge, and from sheer weariness and weakness staggered and fell. He lay for some time, without movement on his side. Then he slipped out of the pack straps and clumsily dragged himself into a sitting posture. It was not yet dark, and in the lingering twilight, he groped about among the rocks for shreds of dry moss. When he had gathered a heap, he built a fire, a smoldering, smudgy fire, and put a tin pot of water on to boil. He unwrapped his pack, and the first thing he did was to count his matches. There were 67. He counted them 3 times to make sure. He divided them into several portions, wrapping them in oil paper, disposing of one bunch in his empty tobacco patch, of another bunch in the inside band of his battered hat, of the third bunch under his shirt on the chest. This accomplished, a panic came upon him, and he unwrapped them all and counted them again. There were still 67. He dried his wet foot gear by the fire. The moccasins were in soggy shreds. The blanket socks were worn through in places, and his feet were raw and bleeding. His ankle was throbbing, and he gave it an examination. It had swollen to the size of his knee. He tore a long strip from one or two of his blankets and bound the ankle tightly. He tore other strips and bound them about his feet to serve for both moccasins and socks. Then he drank a pot of water, steaming hot, wound his watch, and crawled between his blankets. Then he slept like a dead man. The brief darkness around midnight came and went. The sun arose in the northeast. At least the day dawned in that quarter, for the sun was hidden by gray clouds. At 6 o'clock he awoke, quietly lying on his back. He gazed straight up into the gray sky and knew that he was hungry. As he rolled over on his elbow, he was startled by a loud snore and saw a bull caribou regarding him with alert curiosity. The animal was now more than 50 feet away, and instantly into the man's mind leaped the vision and the savor of caribou steak sizzling and frying over a fire. Mechanically, he reached for the empty gun, drew a bead, and pulled the trigger. The bull snorted and leaped away, his hoofs rattling and clattering as he fled across the ledges. The man cursed and flung away the empty gun from him. He groaned aloud as he started to drag himself to his feet. It was a slow and arduous task. His joints were like rusty hinges. They worked harshly in their sockets, with much friction, and each bending or unbending was accomplished only through a sheer exertion of will. When he finally gained his feet, another minute or so was consumed in straightening up so that he could stand erect as a man should stand. He crawled up a small knoll and surveyed the prospect. There were no trees, no bushes, nothing but a gray sea of moss, scarcely diversified by gray rocks, gray lakelets, and gray streamlets. The sky was gray. There was no sun, nor hint of sun. He had no idea of north, and he had forgotten the way he had come to this spot the night before. But he was not lost. He knew that. Soon he would come to the land of the little sticks. He felt that it lay off to the left somewhere, not far, possibly just over the next low hill. He went back to put his pack into shape for traveling. He assured himself of the existence of his three separate parcels of matches, though he did not stop to count them. But he did linger, debating, over a squat moose hide sack. It was not large. He could hide it under his two hands. He knew that it weighed 15 pounds, as much as all the rest of the pack, and it worried him. He finally set it to one side and proceeded to roll the pack. He paused to gaze at the squat moose-hide sack. He picked it up hastily with a defiant glance about him, as though the desolation were trying to rob him of it. And when he rose to his feet to stagger into the day, it was included in the pack on his back. He bore away to the left, stopping now to eat muskeg berries. His ankle had stiffened. His limp was more pronounced. But the pain of it was as nothing compared with the pain of his stomach. The hunger pangs were sharp. They gnawed and gnawed until he could not keep his mind steady on the course he must pursue to gain the land of the little sticks. The muskeg berries did not allay this gnawing, while they made his tongue and the roof of his mouth sore with the irritating bite. He came upon a valley where the rock ptarmigan rose on whirring wings from the ledges and muskegs. Kerr, kerr, kerr was the cry they made. He threw stones at them, but could not hit them. He placed his pack on the ground and stalked them as a cat stalks a sparrow. The sharp rocks cut through his pants legs till his knees left a trail of blood, but the hurt was lost in the hurt of his hunger. He squirmed over the wet moss, saturating his clothes and chilling his body, but he was not aware of it. So great was his fever for food. And always the ptarmigan rose, whirring before him, till their kerr, kerr, kerr became a mock to him, and he cursed them and cried aloud at them with their own cry. Once he crawled upon one that must have been asleep. He did not see it till it shot up in his face from its rocky nook. He made a clutch as startled as was the rise of the ptarmigan, and there remained in his hand three tail feathers. As he watched his flight, he hated it, as though it had done him some terrible wrong. Then he returned and shouldered his pack. As the day wore along, he came into valleys and swales where game was more plentiful. A band of caribou passed by, 20-odd animals, tantalizingly within rifle range. He felt a wild desire to run after them, a certitude that he could run them down. A black fox came toward him, carrying a ptarmigan in his mouth. The man shouted. It was a fearful cry, but the fox, leaping away in fright, did not drop the ptarmigan. Late in the afternoon, he followed a stream, milky with lime, which ran through sparse patches of rush grass. Grasping these rushes firmly near the root, he pulled up what resembled a young onion sprout, no larger than a shingle nail. It was tender, and his teeth sank into it with a crunch that promised deliciously of food. But its fibers were tough. It was composed of stringy filaments saturated with water, like the berries, and devoid of nourishment. He threw off his pack and went into the rush grass on hands and knees, crunching and munching like some bovine creature. He was very weary and often wished to rest, to lie down and sleep, but he was continually driven on, not so much by his desire to gain the land of the little sticks as by his hunger. He searched little ponds for frogs and dug up the earth with his nails for worms, though he knew in spite that neither frogs nor worms existed so far north. He looked into every pool of water vainly, until, as the long twilight came on, he discovered a solitary fish, the size of a minnow, in such a pool. He plunged his arm in up to the shoulder, but it eluded him. He reached for it with both hands and stirred up the milky mud at the bottom. In his excitement, he fell in, wetting himself to the waist. Then the water was too muddy to admit of his seeing the fish, and he was compelled to wait until the sediment had settled. The pursuit was renewed till the water was again muddied, but he could not wait. He unstrapped the tin bucket and began to bail the pool. He bailed wildly at first, splashing himself and flinging the water so short a distance that it ran back into the pool. He worked more carefully, striving to be cool, though his heart was pounding against his chest and his hands were trembling. At the end of half an hour, the pool was nearly dry. Not a cupful of water remained, and there was no fish. He found a hidden crevice among the stones, through which it escaped to the adjoining and larger pool, a pool which he could not empty in a night and a day. Had he known of the crevice, he could have closed it with a rock at the beginning, and the fish would have been his. Thus he thought, and crumpled up, and sank down upon the wet earth. At first he cried softly to himself, then he cried loudly to the pitiless desolation that ringed him around, and for a long time after, he was shaken by great sobs. He built a fire, and warmed himself by drinking quarts of hot water, and made camp on a rocky ledge in the same fashion he had the night before. The last thing he did was to see that his matches were dry, and to wind his watch. The blankets were wet and clammy. His ankle pulsed with pain. But he knew only that he was hungry, and through his restless sleep, he dreamed of feasts and banquets and of food served and spread in all imaginable ways. He awoke chilled and sick. There was no sun. The gray of earth and sky had become deeper, more profound. A raw wind was blowing, and the first flurries of snow were whitening the hilltops. The air about him thickened and grew white while he made a fire and boiled more water. It was wet snow, half rain, and the flakes were large and soggy. At first they melted as soon as they came in contact with the earth, but ever more fell, covering the ground, putting out the fire, spoiling his supply of moss fuel. This was a signal for him to strap on his pack and stumble forward. He knew not where. He was not concerned with the land of the little sticks, nor with Bill and the cache under the upturned canoe by the River Dease. He was mastered by the verb, to eat. He was hunger mad. He took no heed of the course he pursued, so long as that course led him through the swale bottoms. He felt his way through the wet snow to the watery muskeg berries, and went by feel as he pulled up the rush grass by the roots. But it was tasteless stuff, I did not satisfy. He found a weed that tasted sour, and he ate all he could find of it, which was not much, for it was a creeping growth, easily hidden under the several inches of snow. He had no fire that night, nor hot water, and crawled under his blanket to sleep the broken hunger sleep. The snow turned into a cold rain. He awakened many times to feel it falling on his upturned face. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.